أشهد أن محمد رسول الله. أشهد أن محمد.
السلام عليكم. Peace be unto you. We're back for another episode of Islam in Focus. Today we have our 28th program in our series dealing with the sources of Islam. We'll be having our fifth segment in the dealing with the linguistic miracle of the Quran. More particularly today, we'll be looking at the flow of the meaning in the Quran. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me on the program as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi.
Going into so much detail in the title, I almost had my tongue in the throat. I wonder, Brother Jamal, if before we get into the meat of today's program, if I could have you very quickly summarize the main points that we touched on last week in our program dealing with the linguistic miracle of the Quran.
Sure. The last program dealt mainly with the precision and the expressions in the Quran in such a way that there could be no way that one can improve on the selection of words. We have seen that what may appear as an extra word or an extra letter or just a synonymous word that another word could have replaced it is not true, and that there is absolutely nothing extra, nothing less in the Quran. We spoke also of sometimes what may appear like dropping a word here or there that should have been in the sentence, but again we found that there is very good reason behind the style of the Quran, concluding that there is absolutely no room to replace one word or even one letter in the Quran without reducing the effectiveness and the eloquence of its expression. And he said that there is no human writing whatsoever that we know of that can claim to have absolutely no room for even the slightest improvement or editing, that it is all of consistent high quality from the A to the Z. And that becomes even more amazing if we realize that the Quran was revealed to the Prophet spontaneously. He did not sit down to think and write and correct and edit and delete this and add that. It all came despite of himself. And that shows that the Quran cannot be explained by way of human phenomena. It must really be divine revelation.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if I could have you comment on the apparent lack of symmetry in some of the passages of the Quran.
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been some orientalists also, and those who are not totally familiar with the Quran, who, for example, point out to the fact that in some cases the passage in the Quran would be using a singular and all of a sudden uses a plural form. A very clear example of this is in Surah 2, in Ayah 257. Allah waliyu alladhina amanu yukhrijuhum min adh-dhulumati ila an-nur. It says Allah is the protector of those who are believers. He brings them from darkness, and the Arabic word here, dhulumat, is a plural. You cannot detect that in the English translation, because in English it says darkness. But the original Arabic word, dhulumat, plural for darkness. So it says God brings them from the darkness, says, if you will, to light. Now, many people again would see that, like you indicated, as a sort of lack of symmetry. Why in one case it is plural, the other one it is singular? But if you look at it carefully, we notice that whenever the Quran refers to light, which is a symbol of truth, it always uses the singular.
Yes.
Why? Because the ultimate truth,
only one.
Exactly, only one. You can't have two contradictory or different ultimate and final truths. There must be one. So light is referred to in a singular. Whereas darkness, which refers to falsehood, could be of different variety. Mm-hmm. You know, people would have their own ways and people have different thinking. So if one deviates from the true path of the Creator, he can follow a variety of ways. So darkness actually is more appropriate to express in a plural sense. So this is something, like I said, again, where it's a subtle difference that only by reflecting further on the Quran, one can discover that every word is put in its proper place.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn now to an examination of the flow of the meaning of the Quran. Some writers have claimed that there doesn't seem to be any apparent connection between the various passages of the same surah or chapter in the Quran. Would you shed some light on that issue?
Sure, this is a common thing that many Orientals, especially people who write encyclopedias and books that sounds authoritative for the Western reader, but unfortunately they're mistaken. And the basic complaint, like you indicated, they say the Quran deals with a whole variety of diverse subjects that doesn't seem to make a consistent whole altogether. And that led some of them to give a number of interpretations, all of which are erroneous. Some writers said that maybe the reason why the Quran deals with so many subjects is to reduce the boredom. So it just talk about topics that do not fit, just so that the reader does not get too bored because of constancy or monotony of one subject. Others said that it is mainly to keep the rhyme of the Quran, as if the Quran sacrifices the consistency of meaning just to maintain beautiful and varying rhyme, just to make the reader enjoy reading it. The majority of particularly Orientalists has given another reason. They said maybe that lack of apparent consistency or time between the topics, diverse as they may be, is because not the Prophet himself, but because of his companions after him. That is when the companions put together or compiled the various parts of the Quran, they just put it in a haphazard manner. Now, Dr. Jazz comment on all of this, quote-unquote, erroneous explanation that, as far as historical facts that we know, the Quran is today in the exact same order, in the exact same precise covering of the topics, as revealed to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and as he directed the companions to put, and as he himself was directed by the angel of revelation to put it. So, in other words, the whole basis for this kind of interpretation is not really well-founded. So that leaves us with only one of two things, if these excuses are not correct historically. Either that it is true that the Quran is lacking in this question of connection between the diversity of topics it deals with, or that those who came up with this conclusion did so in a haste, did not study the Quran in sufficient depth, and try to understand the Quran in its own context, rather than in the context of other conventional books, which I believe to be the case.
When you speak of the Quran in its own context, what do you mean?
Well, you see, the Quran is a unique book. It is not like any other human authored book, because it's not human authored. It's not basically a book of law, even though it contains law. It is not basically a book of science, even though, as we have seen in several previous programs, it includes many statements that science discovered only recently. That's not basically a book of science. This is on chemistry, this is on physics, and this is on geology. It is not basically a book on sociology or political science or economics, even though all of these things are included. If the Quran was like any other human authored books, then those writers would have been correct, because we are used to say, right, this book deals with that subject, and then even within that subject, there is one chapter dealing with one aspect, so you finish with that and move on to another one, you don't repeat. The Quran, above all, is a book of divine guidance to guide humanity in all aspects of their lives. And it's not only just guidance, it's a book also to be read for worship, for moving the heart and moving or stimulating the mind. And imagine somebody reading the one chapter or surah in the Quran dealing with nothing but law, with nothing but economics, and use that in the matter of worship. That's not really the nature and the style of the Quran. As Muhammad Rashid Reda, one of the prominent writers on the Quranic revelation, says that if the Quran were ordered in the way some of those academics or Orientalists think is best, the Quran would have lost its measures and distinctive characteristic as a book to move the heart and to guide the human beings. The other thing that should be remembered also is that many of those Orientalists and critics, they come normally from a Judeo-Christian background. And of course they are more accustomed to the chronology that you find in the Bible, which starts all the way from the story of creation down to the Old Testament prophets, you know, down to the New Testament, to the disciples of Jesus and so on, and their works. And even if they were not necessarily influenced by the style of the Bible, which is basically a chronology of history, they are raised up in an environment which tend to divide life into compartments, separate compartments. This is politics, this is religious, this is moral. So even if they try to be fair in their writing about the Quran, they fail to understand the Quran and Islam in general does not accept this compartmentalization of human life into these separate compartments. The Quran makes no distinction, essentially, between the nature of worshipping God in terms of basic rites or rituals, or worshipping God in the political arena or social arena or economic aspects. So the morals, the social, the economic, all of them mesh together, they're intermingled. They fail to understand that Islam is basically a complete way of life, and that is reflected in the Quran, trying to harmonize and integrate all these aspects of life in one integrated whole. As a result, you may find that even in a small passage in the Quran, a few verses, the word verse is not quite accurate, but usually people refer to that, in the very small part or portion, you find discussion of moral teachings, social organization, stories of the Prophet, but not again stories for the sake of history, but to pick certain lesson out of that story. So the main point I'm saying here, what I mean by the Quran's own context, is that one cannot impose another alien framework within which to understand the Quran. One must understand the Quran within its own framework, within its own context, and keeping in mind also both the micro and macro levels of understanding.
Well, you use the words micro and macro. Most people, when they hear those terms, think of economics. Perhaps you could explain to us what you mean when you talk about the micro and macro approaches to the understanding of the Quran.
Well, it applies to economics and industrial relations in many disciplines. Well, it sounds like a big term, but it's basically simple, really. It refers to looking at something very specific in detail, the micro, or versus something on a larger or more broader framework. But maybe to adopt a little bit or adapt from Dr. Jaz with some modification, perhaps, he says that if you try to examine a beautiful painting, if you examine it simply by looking at one specific portion, a couple of square inches, you might say that that small part is beautiful. It's nicely designed. It has beautiful colors. But if you just keep focusing on the micro level, on this one small segment of the painting, you might say, I can't see, even though it's beautiful, how does it fit with other beautiful pieces?
Mm-hmm.
How does it fit with other square inches? The only way that you can appreciate how these parts of the total painting fit together is not to get too close, but to have the macro view, to get back far enough so that you can look at it as a whole. And this way you can appreciate the beauty of it. You can appreciate how the various parts fit together when you take the totality of the painting. The same thing you can apply when you examine a beautifully designed piece of yarn. You can apply it when you look at some kind of arabesque design, mosaic. Again, taking small part doesn't make sense, but you look at it as a whole, then you can get a better perception and better appreciation. Now, I'm not trying to say that we should evaluate the Quran in the same way we evaluate a painting, because these are human-made, the paintings or the yarn, whereas the Quran is basically divine revelation, so we can't make a completely correct analogy. But I'm just to make the meaning closer to our minds. If you also look at the Quran in terms of one specific segment, one small part of a surah or chapter, quote-unquote, a few verses, if you will, you might say, all right, it makes sense, it's beautiful, like we discussed last time, it's very precise and expression and so on. But how does it relate to the various topics, to this diversity of the areas covered in the same surah or the same unit of the Quran? But again, you need to do the same thing. You have to go back a little and examine the entirety of the surah or unit of the Quran. And only then can you see the flow of meaning and how the various parts that otherwise may not look connected, in fact, do connect very nicely with each other. So this is a far removed notion from the idea that the Quran was just collected in a haphazard way. Yes, it has a unique style, but it's not haphazard at all.
Well, perhaps to assist our viewers and others to more fully appreciate your point, how about an example to illustrate this a little bit further?
Well, examples are numerous. In fact, there are volumes on that. But I just chose one summarized one, and I'm summarizing that also. Mm-hmm. In the book by Dr. Jaz, for example, An-Naba' al-Azim, or the Omnious News, which deal with the authority of the Quran, he spent about 50 pages just commenting in a very summarized way about the second surah in the Quran, the cow. It's called Al-Baqarah, number 2. The main thing to notice here is that this is a big challenge that he took upon himself, because he did not take a small chapter or surah which is composed of a few verses where he can say, all right, you know, we can see this is the way it connects. He actually took the longest surah in the Quran. 286 passages are included in the same unit, and it deals with a whole variety of topics. But one way of understanding its connectedness is that he says basically it has an introduction, four basic objectives that the surah conveys, and a conclusion. Just like, you know, neat and perfect sort of flow from beginning to end. But in the introduction, which is covered mainly in the first 20 passages in the Quran, or that surah, it's basically an introduction of the Quran, indicating that there is no doubt that in this Quran there is guidance for mankind. But since it talks about the guidance of the Quran, it starts dealing with the attitude and response of people towards the Quran. And it starts by giving the profile of those who accept it, or who accept or believe in this guidance. And this has good reason also. Why did it start with the believers? Because the last part of the verse says, Huda lil-muttaqin, guidance for those who are Allah conscious, or those who are righteous. So beginning to talk about the believers is actually describing those righteous people. So it's almost like you call it a golden bridge, so that you move from one meaning to the other without the reader or hearer, listener to the Quran, noticing that there's any change in the meaning. It flows very nicely. And then it deals with the other side. How about those who reject the guidance of the Quran deliberately? So it deals again with their description and their profile. And then it deals with a third group who are neither believers nor rejectors, knowing that the Quran is the truth. Those who are confused, who are hesitant, and it gives again the profile of those people. Now, having dealt with the nature of the guidance of the Quran, the responses of the three categories of people, it moves on beyond that introduction to the first objective of the surah. And the first objective is simply to invite the rest of mankind, all mankind, to follow the guidance of Allah, the guidance of God, as narrated in the Quran. And this is again a very nice connection, because you have talked about categories of people in their response to the Quran, and then you ended by inviting everybody to the path of truth, all categories. Now, in this particular coverage, you find that it talks about believing in Allah, worshipping Him, obeying Him, to remember His bounties on us, to challenge those who say that the Quran is from human source, to produce something like it, to discuss the creation of Adam initially and the purpose of creation. So it's basically connected with the invitation to the path of truth. And then it moves to the second main objective of the surah, which is very much related to the first. Because in the first objective, you're inviting all mankind. The second part or portion deals with the invitation specifically of the so-called people of the book, mainly Jews and Christians, because they share a lot with Muslims, believe in God, believe in prophets and revelation and so on. And that is a major part of the surah, and it explains lots of things about the attitudes of the people of the book, the history of the Israelites being a history where we can take lots of lessons from what happened, relating that to the contemporary history during the lifetime of the Prophet, relating that to the relationship with Prophet Abraham as a source or patriarch that is highly respected by the followers of these three major religions, indicating that his religion basically was Islam or submission to God, talking about the blessing of his descendants, Isaac and Ishmael. And that relates also to the Qibla, or the direction of prayer, and why it was changed to the original house in the Kaaba. In the third objective, we find that there is a nice flow also. You invite people. You specify the people of the book with the invitation to faith. And then the third part of the surah describes what is that faith that you're inviting people to. And that's a very major part of the surah, the major part of it, in fact, runs perhaps all the way from 163 to 283, indicating the nature of Islam that they are invited to, the belief in Allah as the ultimate authority and sovereign of the universe, certain aspects of lawful and unlawful in food, drink, economic activities, things pertaining to criminal law, inheritance, fasting, pilgrimage, a whole lot of gamuts of topics, marriage, marital life. But even when it deals with this, it does not deal with it one topic. It finishes with fasting and never come back to it, or pilgrimage. Many times you find the missing, so that the nature of complementarity and cohesiveness and interrelatedness of various aspects of life are emphasized. Then it moves to the fourth objective of the surah, to indicate again what is the real motive for people to follow that faith. So that's again connection, which is the fear of God and the love of Him and the individual responsibility, and then end with a conclusion indicating the belief in all prophets and messengers, ending with a very nice prayers for God to guide us and to help us, you know, fulfill our duties and so on. And by the way, this is not the only way that Dr. Bass, for example, is offering to understand that particular surah or unit in the Quran, because throughout history people come up with complementary, but not necessarily contradictory, complementary ways of looking at things, and everyone discovers again how beautifully this meaning connects with each other. There have been many authorities who wrote on that subject, including people like Naisaburi, Ar-Razi, Ibn al-Arabi, and Ash-Shafi. They have written volumes and volumes trying to show this flow of meaning in the Quran. So it would be rather unfair for many Orientalists just to ignore all that literature and just say haphazardly, you know, that the Quran is put together without any order. But the miracle in the Quran really, and in that particular surah, the number two in the Quran, is not necessarily or not only in the way the various parts and the diverse topics it deal with connect very nicely with each other. The greater miracle even can be understood in view of the timing and the circumstances under which the surah was revealed.
So could you tell us something about the timing and the circumstances of the revelation, and why you consider it to be miraculous?
I consider it to be even more miraculous than the consistency of meaning, for a simple reason, is that when you look at that surah, when you read it, if somebody doesn't have any background historical about it, you can never tell whether that surah from the surface was revealed all at once, or how long did it take to reveal. Many people might think that it was just revealed at one time, because the meaning flows very nicely. Whereas it is interesting to notice that this surah was revealed in small parts over a period of 9 years. 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily in chronological order. In other words, one part was revealed and the Prophet said, put that here and put that here and put that there, over 9 years. But what is even more fascinating is that many of the parts of that surah were revealed actually in response to certain problems, questions raised by Muslims or non-Muslims, certain events that took place over 9 years. And scholars estimated to come to almost 80 different circumstances. The main question here is, which is really fascinating, I would say comfortably miraculous really, is that how could a human being over a period of 9 years, author a part of the Quran, so that by chance, the 80 incidents that took place over these 80 years would fit very nicely, so that at the end of 8 years, 9 years, the surah comes as an integrated whole. It's rather impossible, really, to assume, even if you say that human being had a computer up in his head, it's very difficult, really, to put it in that particular precision. What is even more fascinating is that how could even any author know the unseen, know what exactly going to happen over 9 years period, 80 different incidents, and then the various revelations come to correct and comment on each of those incidents, and then after 9 years it comes as a perfect integrated whole, unless the author knows or knew in advance everything that's going to happen in the future, and that could be none but the Creator himself.
Do the characteristics that we've been discussing today apply as well to the sayings of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him?
Not really, and this is another interesting thing, because if you recollect from the very early programs in that series, or some 7 months ago, one basic distinction that was made between the Quran and prophetic sayings is that even though both of them are basically revelation, in other words, the Quran was revealed to the Prophet, and the saying that the Prophet uttered, the meaning of which at least was inspired into him. So both of them are based on revelation. But there's something really distinctive and different between Quran and prophetic saying. Because the Quran was revealed to the Prophet as it is, not only in meaning, but in the exact words even that we have today in the Quran. Whereas the saying were just meaning and he used his own words. And the strange thing again, and that could respond to those who may have any question in mind as to whether the Quran could have had any human authorship, or if the Prophet was the author of the Quran, as some mistakenly assume, that the styles of the Quran and Hadith linguistically are quite different, quite apart, even though both of them were uttered by the Prophet. So by the same token, as Dr. Brass suggests, he said that if you apply the same thing that we're talking about in the Quran on the prophetic sayings, you find that it does not have that characteristic at all. In other words, if you connect the saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, with the variety of topics like the Quran it deals with the variety of circumstances in which these sayings were made, just like the Quran, and just put it together in any order you like, it is impossible to come up with something which is as cohesive, as consistent, and as connected as we find in the Quran, which is an actual testimony that the Quran can never be, could have never been a product of any human being. There can be no human explanation of the phenomenon of the Quran.
Well, in the, I don't know the spirit of Rashki, but in the minute or so that we have remaining of today's program, could you give us another example of the style of Quranic expression?
Well, one of those interesting ones, for example, appear in Surah 2, particularly in passages 91 to 94. We wouldn't really have enough time really to go through the details, but you notice here that there are three basic objectives or elements in that expression. To advise the Jews, who were particularly the subject of the verse, to believe in the Quran. To narrate the response to that invitation, and then to respond to their reply. And as Dr. Draz analyzed it, like I said, I wish we had more time to go through it, you find that it's quite different from any human writing, because in human writing, when you're blaming someone or criticizing someone, you criticize all the way. If you're praising, you praise all the way. Sometimes you have difficulty in shifting and being very fair and impartial. But you find that they are advised to believe in what Allah has revealed. The word even, what Allah has revealed, did not say, for example, what has been revealed to Prophet Muhammad, because the essence here is that it is divine revelation. It brings to their attention that as you believed in the Torah, which was revealed from God, you should also believe in the Quran, because it also was revealed from God. It gives a very logical reason, because it confirms what remained intact in your Torah. And you could go on and on analyzing words, the expression, how it's put, how no other words could have expressed the same meaning, it shows again that both the precision of the expression as well as the flow of meaning is something that's really unique. All it requires is a fair and in-depth analysis before we come to conclusions like many writers that the Quran was collected haphazardly. The only haphazard really is their methodology in understanding the Quran.
Indeed. Well, perhaps we'll have some time in a later program to go into more detail than we've had time for in today's program. We want to thank you for watching. Peace be unto you.
أشهد أن محمد